Recording.
We're on, huh? It's blue. We have another big agenda to work through today. We're going to try and work things as expeditiously as we possibly can. First, let me announce that we're going to carry over House Bill 3603, and we will schedule that. In effect, we'll have a public hearing on that on Monday. We're going to carry over House Bill 3611. Senator Maurer and I are working on trying to set up a panel of folks who can come and give us some information on that so we can tee it up for working on even more in the interim. But I expect we'll carry it over again. We'll see what's going on next week. And at the very least, we'll then schedule a hearing for it in the third week, if nothing else. I'm carrying over House Bill 3639. We're still trying to figure out whether to amend that or what to do with it and where to send it, and we'll carry that over, and we'll have the next announcement on Monday about that one.
Yeah.
And we have all the amendments about House Bill 3642. We have all the amendments on it, but we are now waiting for a revised fiscal. And I've checked in with legislative fiscal, and I expect we'll hear that. So 3642 is carried over. I have all those officially in the books, huh?
I hope so.
Okay. I'd like to open a work session on 3626, and I would like a motion on the -3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the -3 amendments to House Bill 3626.
Is there any discussion on the -3 amendments, which the purpose of those, Representative Kotek, totally eliminates the definition? Is that what the -3s do?
That's correct. So for my testimony yesterday on the -2s, it's similar, almost identical to the -2s, except we remove the definition of what the elements of a vision screening would be, because they are incorporated or captured by the goals of the pilot program in the following section. So that's the -3.
Is there any discussion on the -3 amendments? Is there any objection to the -3 amendments? We have the -3 amendments. We have a hall pass, at least, to move it to Ways and Means with the -3s. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, we actually have a full fiscal, so if the members want to see it, I think I might have emailed it to you already, but it is a full fiscal, mm-hmm. So it's good to go.
Fiscal says roughly it's $150,000.
Pretty much.
Since we have $150,000 in the bill.
We'd like to make it easy for those fiscal.
That is what the fiscal says.
All right. May I have a motion on the bill as amended with the -3s, please?
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve House Bill 3632 as amended with the -3 amendments and send it to Ways and Means by prior reference.
And is that with a due pass recommendation?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes. I'd prefer that.
Yeah. Okay.
Could you please repeat the bill number?
The bill is 3632. Am I reading the wrong one?
I think we're on 26,
yes,
aren't we?
3626.
I'm sorry, 3626. But could you also reread the motion for 3626?
Mr. Chair, yes, I move that we send House Bill 3626 with a due pass recommendation as amended with the -3s to Ways and Means.
To the floor. Right?
To the floor.
and be
referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. My bad.
Our ventriloquist isn't doing too well. You're just supposed to move your mouth, and she's supposed to have the words in there. Okay. We have a motion on House Bill 3626. Any discussion on that?
I sure like that number.
Okay. Can we have a roll call, please?
Representative Brune?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Poyle?
Aye.
Representative
Kinnemer? Excused. Oh, yeah, he's getting that shoulder work done.
Representative Kotak?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excused.
Excused.
Vice Chair Harker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bauer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Propose a work session on...
Colleagues, thank you.
On House Bill 3626, the motion passes, and open a work session on House Bill 3632. I need a motion on a dash one amendment, is that right?
That's right.
Mr. Vice Chair, you've been doing pretty well on this.
Yeah, right.
How about a dash one amendment?
I'm afraid to open my mouth again.
Yeah, we get traumatized.
Mr. Chair, move that we approve the dash one amendments to House Bill 3632.
Dash one amendments removes the clause that if it turns out feasible, the health authority should produce a feasibility study. That takes away, removing that takes away the fiscal, we think. It does. Is there discussion on the dash ones? Is there objection to the dash ones? Dash ones are in 3632. Now, can I have a motion to we also have the approval from the speaker now that the fiscal is zero to move 3632 to the floor directly if we pass it. So can I have a motion that includes also the removal of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means? Mm-hmm. And while our ventriloquist is working out her act here.
Okay, I think this will do it, Mr. Chair. It's a motion to send House Bill 3632 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor and rescind the Ways and Means referral.
Is there discussion on the motion we have on the floor from Representative Harker to move 3632 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I don't believe that, in fact, we need a law, and I discussed that briefly, to study the viability of pay-per-play. Mm. I appreciate the fact that there is no longer fiscal. That was a pretty significant issue in the conversation. I question whether or not pay-or-play is something that we need to look at in the future. Therefore, I will be voting no, but will be anxious to engage in the policy discussion.
Great. Is there any other discussion on House Bill 3632 as amended? Would you please call the roll on the motion?
Representative Broome?
No.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Hoyle?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Excused.
Representative Kotak?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Six affirmatives.
Six,
yes. Six, yes. Motion carries. Close the work session on... Oh, we need a carrier on this one, don't we? We'll have Representative Witt carry that on the floor. And we'll close the work session on 3632. Okay. Did I already announce we're carrying over...
And you can do it again,
3639?
But you can do it again.
We will be carrying over 3639 to Monday. And 3642 we will be also carrying over until Monday. We're into public hearing territory. Again, we have heard most of these things in prior sessions, but not in this month, so we need to at least have pro forma public hearings, and we'll, we will ask you to be brief as you can be, convincing in the ones that we've already had hearings on. So I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3663, and we'll ask Mr. Cross and Ms. Heim to join us at the podium, please, for testimony. We are going to carry this bill over for a work session next week, so this will be simply a relatively brief pro forma public hearing. In any order. Mr. Cross, you were first on the list. Why don't you start?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. We presented this bill to you in January. It would allow adolescents the age between 15 and 18 to access eye care treatment through optometric physicians without parental consent. And we provided at that time some different examples of how this would be important in certain cases for adolescents to be able to obtain that, and less expensive than referrals to the ER in cases of emergencies or urgent care needs. And I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Good. Let's hear from Ms. Heim first, and then we'll open the floor for questions from both of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, which is the statewide professional association of medical physicians and surgeons specializing in eye care. And I would describe our members' reaction to this bill more of being perplexed by it. They say that they do not provide treatment to unemancipated minors without parental consent because they don't believe that's a good healthcare practice. One of their concerns about the bill from last session has been addressed by the language that you added to the bill, Mr. Chair, pertaining to contact lens fitting. They felt very strongly that parents should know about teenagers getting contact lenses. Their second concern relates to prescriptions and possible side effects of some of the prescriptions that contain steroids or might contain narcotics, etc. They just feel that it's better that parents know about the treatment given to their minor children. It's my understanding that there is an amendment that will be proposed by one of Representative Cannon's students, and with that amendment, which would require notification to the parent of a treatment or prescription, then we would withdraw our opposition to the bill because that addresses one of their major concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions of the panel? Okay.
I do have a question. Whose amendment? Was it yours? The dash three? Excuse me, the dash one?
Yes, thank you. As I think members of the committee know, I have a group of students who are following the legislature. I'm a teacher. And when I was looking at bills that they might be interested in, a group of adolescents that we were dealing with this February, this bill sort of rose to the top of the list. So we've talked about the bill in class. They heard some of the testimony on it, and one of the students suggested that perhaps it would be appropriate for the optometrist to provide notification within some number of hours or days after providing treatment. That was his suggestion. We went ahead and had the amendment drafted. In subsequent to that, and since it's sort of been out to the world, we're getting feedback. I'm getting feedback from from others, and certainly interested in any feedback from members of the committee on this, and, you know, we can decide how to proceed. I have no, like I say, it really was his idea. I agreed to have it drafted, much as we would draft amendments for constituents or, you know, others, and I have no particularly strong personal position on this.
Mr. Cross, you had a sense that the part of the bill that puts optometric physicians into the section of the code that allows them to notify the parents. Would you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Section 2 of the proposed bill would allow optometric physicians to communicate with parents with a waiver so that they're not, I mean, they would have the same exception to the HIPAA laws and whatnot as other listed prescribers and providers would have. Currently, when a parent makes an appointment, that is parental consent, but if the adolescent is unaccompanied, the results of the treatment is communicated. That's a normal course of practice with the parents. So we wanted to make sure Section 2 was amended if indeed the parent wasn't able to accompany the adolescent to the appointment, that we would be able to communicate the nature of the treatment.
I'm sorry. So, Bill, was that supporting the amendment or not supporting the amendment?
Well, the amendment would require a duty, I mean, and within 48 hours, and I've reviewed that with the optometric physicians, and as I say, that's sort of a normal course of practice that would occur now when the parent isn't able to attend the appointment with the adolescent. So we philosophically don't have an issue with what that would try and require as a duty. I'm just pointing out that we want to ensure we have that ability to continue to do with the waiver.
Okay, we'll get back to this when we go into work session.
Thompson has
a question.
Who has?
Thompson.
Hello, sir. Welcome.
This is maybe not really on target, but we talked about this bill being for primarily for students injured on the soccer field, and the coach tells them you need to go to the optometrist right away to have that looked at, or, you know, opening the door for that. How in the blazes would the optometrist get paid if he didn't notify the parents? I don't know, too many kids on the soccer field with a couple hundred bucks in their pocket, they're going to shell out to the optometrist. I mean, isn't it sensible that this communication would happen?
Well, this allows the communication to happen in the current.
Yeah, period. Right. I mean, I think it's good to allow it to happen, but I think it's a little stronger than that. I can't imagine why a student wouldn't want their parents to pay the bill. My kids certainly did.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I think that's very good. Yes, I think you're correct. That would be the normal practice. Somebody is going to.
I guess my comment really is there's a relationship here between the doctor, the parent, and the student that is financial, and that might be quite an incentive to why would you hide the treatment?
No, it's my kids had poor parents, but my grandkids seem to have richer parents. So I'm not sure how.
I know we can't apply logic to any of these things. I realize that, but it just.
Okay, I'm happy to, if everybody's happy, to close the public hearing and carry this over to a work session on Monday or Wednesday, possibly, of next week. Close the public hearing on 3663 and carry it over for the record. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3665, please. And who do we have on the list? Must have Nikki at least, is that right? Come on, it's your bill, you start. And Nikki is all we have, so you have the whole burden, go for it.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, always a pleasure to be in front of you. Thanks for having me this afternoon for 3665. I have had a chance, again, to connect with all of you on this bill. This is the bill that would create a provision that prohibits insurance companies from setting fees and rates for services that they are not covering in their insurance plans.
Are there questions? I have a question if nobody else does.
Yeah, I've got several questions.
Okay, you want to start?
Mm-hmm. Well, so my understanding is...
Me too.
That this bill would prohibit any negotiated contract from including a provision that deals with non-covered services. And when we heard testimony originally, I thought that we were talking about addendums, unnegotiated pieces of a contract that show up later, which were routine from happening. And so I want, if there was a conversation about that, did I misunderstand originally, and you came to my office and we had a conversation, and I still have a problem with the whole point of, if you have a negotiated contract and it's up front, that you should be able to negotiate whatever you want in the contract, and or exclude whatever you don't want in the contract. But I'm also very cognizant, having owned a really small clinic, that a company like a Delta Dental, which is a large, and us, which were tiny, but there was no negotiation. They said, here's the contract, and it's all or nothing. There's no negotiation involved. So in fact, in that, the power relationship is not equal at all. And if it's a large number of clients that you're dealing with, then in fact it would have a huge impact on your practice. Comments?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Maurer, yes. Initially, the birth of this legislation came because these contracts were being amended midterm. The edict, I guess you would call it, was sent out effective January 1, 2010. This new provision would be included in their contracts. So that is the impetus for this legislation. This bill will, and I feel like I've been pretty straightforward, this bill will prohibit contracts from including non-covered services. And due to antitrust laws, of course, dentists cannot negotiate en masse. They cannot organize and negotiate their own contracts. That would be price setting, that would be collusion. So we have no recourse really but to go through policy, to go through advocacy, and to come here through government.
Are other questions?
Just a comment. I've had nobody come in opposition. These are just questions I have, and I'm, where is it? Am I incorrect in my thought process? I'm interested because, you know, we have colleagues here who look at these things very differently, and I'm wondering if, how am I reading this? Am I reading it wrong?
I have some questions as well, and Nikki knows that, but let me ask you specifically. This sounds like the way some insurance companies develop PPO models, where essentially they get negotiated agreements with providers to provide fees at a certain price, less than other kinds of prices. And I wonder how this is different from that. And would this prohibit the development of a PPO that had dental coverage as a part of it? I mean, it seems a little odd to me. I do understand the difference of power, which I think is important, but it would seem to me, I'm not sure why a dental insurer can't come in and say, you want to be a part of my network, here's what you have to do. I mean, here's what we'll pay you for coverage services, and we also want you to set a schedule of payments for non-covered. And, I mean, I think that goes on the medical side, doesn't it? Is that an unusual thing?
I mean, my experience is no, it doesn't happen, and I looking for nods or head nods or, I don't think it happens on the medical side. Medicare, if it's a non-covered service, the beneficiary has to sign advanced beneficiary notification that says this is a non-covered service and that the client is in fact liable for the cost of that service.
Whatever the charge is?
Whatever the charge is. And if you don't have that pre-signed, then guess who eats it? It's the provider. So that's, and that's actually fine, and I don't have a problem with that. But this is a little, this is different than that. I mean, not,
yeah.
So it just, it strikes me odd. I don't know what other states do. I'm not trying to, like, kill the bill, but I'm also, it's like I'm trying to get my arms around, because the dental world and the medical world is very different. I mean, they've grown up very different since the implementation of Medicare. So I don't want to, I'm wondering.
Well,
I'm looking for Tina to, like, weigh in.
If there's no other public testimony, then I think the thing to do is to hold this for a work session, and we can discuss these things here in a work session. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify on this? Okay.
As in, there is no opposition?
I haven't heard anybody in opposition to it. Has anybody? Have you?
Chair Greenlick, no, thank you.
My feeling is that this is pretty straightforward. You have dentists who are generally small, independent businesses, so it's not like larger. It's very different than medical practice. It's not like where you have larger practices. These contracts would say you have to charge a certain price for procedures that are not at all covered, and that doesn't seem to make sense to me. I mean, this seems pretty straightforward. It doesn't. There's no opposition that I know of. I think Ms. Tressler has done a great job of communicating with the insurance company and other people, and it just seems like a very straightforward fix that would allow dentists to charge what they need to charge, people to get access to dental care, but maybe I'm not understanding the complexity of it. Seems straightforward.
My comment is, I agree, this is pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what are the unintended consequences or the implications of it? And I don't know the answer. I mean,
I'm
prodding to find out if there's, in fact, opposition that I just don't. I mean, is somebody asleep at the wheel?
We have gotten several letters. I don't think anybody's missed this. We have gotten several emails supporting the position.
And
we have none.
I don't think we're missing anything.
No.
Okay.
No. And one question you asked was about other states. Do I remember correctly that our conversation there was mention of what's going on in other states? Perhaps you could refresh this memory?
Chair Greenlick, Rep. Parker, thank you. Yes. About 20 other states, between 15 and 20 other states across the country are doing this now. One of the reasons that we're really hoping to get this done here in February is so that we can stay ahead of the curve on this one. There's also a little bit of movement happening at the national level. The National Commission of Insurance Legislators, I believe, NCOIL, is having some discussion about this in March as well.
Okay, well, nothing to stop it. I'll close the public hearing and open up a
Thank
work
you.
Session on House Bill 3665. Can I have a motion on House Bill 3665?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3665 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any further discussion on 3665? Okay. You call the roll on the motion, please?
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative
Coyle? Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Excused. Kinnamer is excused for the whole day.
Representative Nathan Pitt?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. Is a volunteer to carry it on the floor?
I will.
Representative Maurer will carry it. That's who you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Maurer will carry it. Close the work session on.
It's right.
Will I do what?
Will you talk to 366 because
okay.
We're waiting
for something. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3665. and open a public hearing on House Bill 3666. And who do we have? Mr. Becker, are you? You up on this one?
And Mr. Chair, I want to just note that you do have some written testimony from Teresa Miller in regards to this bill. She wasn't able to attend the meeting today, so.
And
she is in support of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments.
You know, I'm supposed to ask you what the bill is about.
Oh, you know,
why don't
okay.
we get back in that
no,
habit?
That's, we're will
you,
halfway
will you briefly tell us what this bill is about?
I think it's helpful because I think we're having trouble tracking the numbers. So.
Okay, Mr. Sandy. Chair, members of the committee.
I'm not.
House Bill, excuse me.
House Bill 3666 comes to you at the request of Blue Cross Blue Shield. You remember that this was a committee bill that we had brief testimony on in January. This permits any electronic administration for small employer group or individual health insurance. It authorizes the director of DCBS to approve those rates, discounting the discounted rates due to the electronic administration of that health insurance. It also defines electronic administrative transaction. It has an emergency clause, and Mr. Becker will explain the Dash 1 amendments.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. You have before you House Bill 3666 that would basically allow health insurers to apply premium discounts to insured groups and individual plans that use electronic methods of plan administration. The bill defines the transactions that would be subject to these discounts. The discounts would not be required of insurers, nor would they be required of purchasers. This is completely voluntary on both sides. But the bill sets up the structure that would allow DCBS, the insurance department, to approve rates that offer these discounts off the standard paper transaction rates. So essentially, the bill has the culmination of three things that I think should be encouraged in health insurance. First off, administrative and operational efficiency. Secondly, promoting sustainable practices by relying on electronic transactions as opposed to paper transactions. And thirdly, encouraging modest administrative cost savings through the use of electronic transactions. The Dash 1 amendments have been reviewed by Regents and by the Insurance Department, and we approve of those amendments. Essentially what they do, they further clarify that the use of the electronic transactions is voluntary by both the insurer and the purchaser. Secondly, they simplify and call out specifically how a carrier obtains and defines these discounts in a rate filing. It is through a schedule of discounts that is included with the filing. And then thirdly, the amendments have technical cleanup that just makes the language consistent throughout the bill. We are aware of no opposition to this bill, and we would encourage the committee to give a due pass recommendation. I will take any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Do we have...
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a quick question. Are there any of your in-state competitors that wouldn't, in your opinion, you may not know this for fact, but in your opinion, wouldn't be able to do this at this point?
Chair Greenlee,
let me see if there's a competitive advantage by against others. But
Chair Greenlee, Representative Brune, I'm not even sure our carrier, Regents, can do this right now. It is something that we all aspire to. It is something that another carrier tried to do in a very small way a number of years ago in regard to encouraging electronic remittance of premium, and that was precluded under the current insurance code because there had to be standard rates for the offering of the product. So this opens up a new avenue and encourages, I think, all the right behavior.
Quick comment?
Sorry. Please.
The big offices are doing electronic transactions anyway, but that's not really the where most of your paper transactions occur. It's in the very small independent offices is where most of the paper transactions are occurring. I'm assuming that that's a yes.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Maurer, I may be confused.
About the relationship between the group and...
Yeah, we are talking about the relationship between the group and the members and the health plan. Or the individual purchaser and the health plan. We are not talking about the relationship between the health plan and the providers.
This isn't about claims. This is about the insurance business, right?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. I'm all good.
just to follow on that point, so I got a letter or a postcard from my insurer saying that my benefits statement this year was available online. They were not mailing it to me. And, of course, they're able to do that. Apparently, they're able to do that. But they're not able, under current law, to offer a discount to somebody who enrolls in a plan knowing that chooses a plan knowing that the things like benefit statements and other communication will be handled electronically.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, that is correct. There are certain things that are done electronically now. This will provide the incentives to move that to a whole new level.
Okay. Thank you. We don't have the fiscal statement on this, even with or without the amendment, so we will close the public hearing, carry this House Bill 3666 over.
Did you want to adopt the amendment?
Oh, that's a good idea. Okay. And first, we will open a work session on House Bill 3666 for the purpose of adopting the Dash 1 amendments. Sure. I have a motion for that, Representative Maurer.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3666.
Is there any discussion on those amendments?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
because I made the mistake of volunteering to go paperless, I do not actually have amendments. As far as I know, they're not available online through our...
No. Amendments don't get
really
posted
good.
Online.
You're really good.
And sure. Did you expect some kind of discount or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Would you like to borrow our paper amendments? Or?
No. Did you not give...
Let's take a moment to give everybody a chance to review the amendment.
I think so.
No, I didn't get it on email either.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It appears that there are others on the committee that didn't get the dash ones.
Here's an amendment.
All right, let's we're going to have to carry it over anyway. So let's close the work session.
Sorry.
Carry House Bill 3666 over. We'll make sure everybody gets the dash one amendments to it. I think this going paperless is a really great idea. It's just going to take us a little adjusting, and I think we'll be fine before we're done with it.
Does the committee have a problem if they have packets at the dais, all of them, everybody, in addition to the electronic, even though I sent out an email asking your preference?
Well, from now on, that can be fairly small.
Let's not do that?
So.
Okay.
Yeah, let's keep trying to do it this way. But
okay,
it is important to make sure amendments get where we need to go, because those are not necessarily.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll have paper copies of all amendments that we're going to be considering.
That would help. Actually, I do have the amendments. It's on the link. So I just want to say you did right.
I did mail it?
Okay. I have a better computer. I don't know. I get the paperless thing.
We'll look over your shoulder.
Okay. Sorry. I mean.
Okay. 3666 is carried over. We have to carry everything over to Monday. We only carry everything one at a time. When we're done today, we'll issue another agenda for Monday that will be a little clearer. The agendas are so long because of our short time frame, we have to carry everything over, and we had to post today everything we might possibly do Monday, Wednesday, or Thursday, so you got the whole enchilada. I did close the public hearing on 3666. I will open a public hearing on 3664.
Correct.
On 3664, and Madam Administrator, will you tell us what that's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this too is a committee bill. This, as you remember, extends Medicaid to foster children that age out of the foster care system to include from 18 to the ages of 21. It also requires the health care authority to request the implementation of the amendment to the state Medicaid plan by March 31st of this year, and then it has an emergency clause. This has a
I'm sorry, you done?
Well, I don't see, we do have a fiscal, but we have a fiscal statement, and I'm putting that out right now.
A fiscal statement, and this will be referred to Ways and Means
yes.
At any rate. Okay. You have a... Representative Kotick, would you introduce this for us just a little bit? And then I think we have a...
Absolutely.
Somebody coming to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As colleagues will remember, we did hear really riveting testimony on this bill, not only in the 2009 session, but when we did the informational last month about the importance of providing transitional care for when young adults age out of foster care up to the age of 21. There is a waiver from the federal government to get Medicaid match for that population if we so chose to wrap that population of adults into our Oregon Health Plan. And I think it's very important. We are essentially the parents of young adults who are aging out of the system. They have no other supports, and as long as we can provide, at least to the age of 21, health insurance, it's a wise thing to do.
Thank you. Can I call Mark McKechnie, Pamela Butler, and Judy Moore Peterson for the first panel? And I think there are some other folks who may not be here yet to testify. Have you heard anything about that?
I don't. These are only the ones I'm aware of.
Okay.
Someone else.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, well, let's take it in the order we've signed up.
Okay.
And Kegney, you want to please kick it off.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the executive director of the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. We have been around for nearly 35 years representing kids in the foster care system. We've represented tens of thousands of children and youth by now, and we represent roughly 1,400 foster children and youth per year in Multnomah County. We have wanted for years to extend OHP coverage to youth who age out of the foster care system, and I think that in previous biennia, due to fiscal reasons and I think to an overestimation of the cost to do that, we haven't done it. We haven't accomplished it. Hopefully now we are poised with better information and a more manageable cost to finally accomplish this goal. I'm sure you've heard by now of the dramatically higher health needs of foster children, and they do not experience a magical cure for their mental health or physical health challenges once they turn 18 or leave the system. And the rates of both mental health disorders and physical conditions are many times higher than their peers in the general population. They also, we know very specifically from a 2005 study done by the Casey Family Foundation, that they experience extremely poor outcomes once they leave the foster care system. It was a study done specifically in Washington and Oregon that found that youth leaving the foster care system experience much higher rates of homelessness, poverty, unemployment, and unfortunately involvement in the criminal justice system. Access to health care would be unattainable for many youth because if they don't have a stable residence and they can't obtain employment and they don't have better options than they do to gain higher education, they're about a tenth less likely to go to college than their peers in the general population, which would at least offer student health care to them if they were able to go to college. Without the safety net of basic health care, they are very unlikely to get a good start in life. And for kids who grow up and are raised and stay with their biological parents to the age of 18 and sometimes beyond the age of 18, most parents would provide medical coverage to them as long as they possibly could, often to age 22 or 23, the maximum that's often allowed by other insurance plans. We think that the people of Oregon who take on the role of parent of these children until they reach adulthood should offer some basic comparable support to them to give them a good start in life. And I will
stop there, as I know you're going to get more information, but I'm glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go on to the panel and then.
Yeah. For the record, Pamela Butler with Children First for Oregon. I don't want to beat the dead horse and repeat everything over and over again. I know you guys have heard from me and a lot of current former foster youth already, and Mark has great information as well. So for me, just want I want to reiterate that this is something that's important to Children First and to me personally as a former foster youth. Like Mark said, aging out of the system, you're our parent, and so I just would be here to say, if you can give me health care to 21, why not? So that would be extremely important and a huge step to giving us the support we need for to become contributing members of society. So I don't want to repeat myself over and over again, but if you have any other questions, I'm here to answer them.
Thank you so very much.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Assistant Director. I'm with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs with the Department of Human Services. And again, I am not going to repeat all the need for health care for this very vulnerable population. We do know that more than half of the kids who are well over half of the kids who are coming out of foster care are without health insurance, and that without that health insurance, they face many more difficulties in addressing some of their emotional, developmental, and health needs, as has already been stated here. According to our estimates, once this program were to be up and running entirely, there would be about an average of 400 folks in that program. We do support the concept, and we commend the sponsors of this potential legislation for addressing this need. We do want to point out that there is a cost, albeit lower, as been acknowledged here. It's about $460,000 general fund for the remainder of this biennium, which would be about $1.3 million in total funds. And then it would be about $1.75 million general fund for next biennium, which would be about $4.6 million total fund for 2011-13.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Why can't you guys just do this? What's the problem here?
It is not built into our budget or our statutory authority at
the
present time.
Why do you need statutory authority? These are adults. Because it's to put them into OHP plus. That's the problem. They're not a category as defined, unless we statutorily define it.
That's correct, Representative Greenlick. And we would also need to apply for permission from the federal government, et cetera, to add this particular group.
Okay. Who we got? Representative Maurer, please.
The numbers on the front don't match the numbers on the back of the fiscal. So if there's an average of 400 clients, and I'm not blaming you because you didn't do it, but
she gets numbers right.
She gets numbers right.
I know that.
So if there are 400 clients on average, and there's a fiscal of $4.4 million per biennium, and that's a total, because federal dollars aren't free, or someone's tax dollars, it comes out to $465 per month to cover one person. That seems like a really expensive health care policy for an 18 to 21-year-old person. I understand that their medical needs are higher on average, but I'm assuming those numbers are across the whole spectrum of the OHP population, and that just seems really, really high.
Representative Greenlick and Representative Maurer, the committee. The costs were built on by looking at and evaluating the costs of the foster care population, particularly the older population, and building it upon that. And you are correct that the healthcare needs are much more intensive for this particular population. Even though they're the 18 to up to 21, there are some emotional, mental health needs that would increase the cost per person.
You use like the 17 and 18 year old, the experience of the kids who are currently in the program because they're in foster care, is what you're saying.
I understand, but they're thrown into a larger population. It's not, we're not saying these foster kids are going to cost this much, and there's, you know, a whole hundred, a lot of thousand kids in Oregon Health Plan, and so now we're going to create categories based on your foster care, and so you cost us more. That seems, you know, an anathema to insurance policy.
So, Chair Green, like Representative Maurer, members of the committee, the foster care children today are separated out as a group because of their intensive needs. It's one of the ways that actually we are required to look at each eligibility category, sort of lump them together according to federal eligibility categories. This would be one of those, and so they actually would need to be not thrown in the overall mix of all the other children or all the other folks who are of the same age group, and they would be treated as a separate category and group of kids, or they're not kids anymore, but adults.
I guess from our perspective, we're really dealing with policy here, particularly since this is going to the Ways and Means, and we did pass this in the last session.
Right. No, we didn't.
Didn't we send it to Ways and Means?
No, if I can remind folks, we had hoped to include this in House Bill 2116. It would have been wrapped into the Healthy Kids discussion related to the provider tax payment mechanism and was removed. But I actually want to comment on that, but I'll wait till the testimonies are done because we might have an opportunity there in terms of changing how this fiscal is written by actually pursuing that.
Okay. Well, if there are other technical questions of this panel, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the department's statement. We see costs, fiscal impact. I note that in a letter we have from you, it says youth leaving foster care have 3 to 7 times as many health, developmental, and emotional problems as other youth from similar socioeconomic backgrounds. Given those problems, I wonder, has the department developed any information for us on cost avoidance? If we spend this money here, we avoid certain other costs that we see accrue to other agencies because they end up with some other need that could have been avoided or it's paid for here. See what I'm saying? Very often, all we get is the straight, here's the direct one cost to here, but not here are the costs or the savings in the other places. Do you have any information for us about that?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Nathanson, I don't, unfortunately, have any information on that. You know, this is a pretty traditional fiscal that shows the fiscal impact as it directly impacts our agency. We can take that back and see what information may be available.
Yeah, it would probably be useful to have that ready for the Ways and Means discussions where that is a really important point.
Thank you,
Representative Nathanson.
May I follow up on that quickly, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
On that note, I'm just wondering, Judy, if there in the legislation we passed last session around prescription, the psychotropic drug use, children in foster care, we've emphasized the need for appropriate ongoing mental health evaluations and assessment of the drugs that children and youth in foster care are taking. And I'm wondering if we will see savings there that will help address some of the ongoing costs, because I think we're, to some degree, and we weren't sure, but we might be over-medicating and we weren't doing proper mental health assessments. So I'm hoping that we might see some improvements in those numbers just by virtue of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had that, if you can track that, that'd be helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
thank you all very much. Yeah, do you have another?
Yes, Chair Greenlee, I'd like to add a couple of things briefly. I have one anecdotal example. I realize it doesn't substitute for data, but we had a client a few years ago who was aging out of the foster care system, and he suffered from rheumatoid arthritis. And his treatments were quite expensive, but they were covered, and his disease was well managed by those treatments when he was covered by the Oregon Health Plan. Once he became an adult, he was able to work, he was able to support himself, but he didn't have health coverage. And without those treatments, he's gradually deteriorated to the point where he could no longer work and support himself. So he had a choice of basically becoming so, his only choice really was to become so disabled that he became unable to work and unable to support himself and to go on public assistance and return to the Oregon Health Plan through that route, as well as receive other public benefits. But with basic health care coverage, he was able to continue working and support himself. And I would say, given the rates of mental health disorders among former foster youth, including a rate of post-traumatic stress disorder that's twice that of U.S. war veterans, that they need medical services, medication, therapies, other support in a similar way to be able to function on a daily basis, to be able to maintain housing, maintain employment, so that they don't eventually have to rely on more and more public support because they're unable to work.
I think you got us on the policy side, so let's...
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me call the final witness. Courtney Willard, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while Ms. Willard is coming up, you were handed some written testimony that we want to acknowledge for the record from Colette Peters of the Oregon Youth Authority in support of 883664.
Great.
Hello, Representative Greenlick and committee members, thanks for having me. My name is Courtney Dillard. I'm one of the founders of the Oregon Center for Christian Values, whose purpose is to speak for the least of these. But I am here primarily today because I am mentoring a youth in the foster care system through Powerhouse Mentoring. And the young woman that I'm mentoring, Sarah Smith, she would have been here today, but I didn't want her to miss school. She,
good choice.
Yep. She's just turned 18. And she is everything that you would hope for in a foster youth. She and I sat down last month and turned in her applications electronically to three different universities in the Oregon system. So she's beating the odds by getting this far. And Sarah's story is one of a lot of pain and hardship, like many youth in foster care. Both of her parents, this is a bit unusual, but both of her parents passed away. She went through kin fostership and now foster care, and now she is in the regular foster care system. But she has survived all of that to earn close to a 3.0 at Benson High School. And we do hope that she'll be able to go to college. But there's a lot of illness in her family. Her sister, her younger sister, Cherise, has lymphoma, her only sister. And she has fallen behind in school because of the disease and probably will not be able to go to college like Sarah might be. But my concern and the reason I'm here is because I feel like I owe it to Sarah to speak for her when she can't speak for herself in a venue like this. And to say that something like an illness for someone like Sarah Smith without coverage between the ages of 18 and 21 would be totally devastating. And the path that we, and when I say we, I mean primarily Sarah in this case, but also myself and the state of Oregon, has tried to set her on. All of the work that was done would be lost by an illness if she did not get to college and she was in a situation where she was sick. She would be taken off the path that all of us worked to set her on. And that's what's worrisome to me, is that the ages of 18 to 21 are key ages for people aging out of the foster care system to become independent adults. And any little thing that we might, people who are perhaps more privileged, might be able to overcome will be a total setback. So I'm here on behalf of Sarah and on behalf of all the youth like her who are trying to do the best they can with the lot that they were given. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. We heard some remarkably compelling stories from young folks who had graduated from foster care and how these life choices were made. We were very, very impressed with them.
Yeah, and one of them sitting in the room, Pamela.
Yes, indeed.
That does sound impressive.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Thanks for being here. Representative Kotick, you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to thank the
Department of... You're the co-chair.
The Department of... Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Whatever.
The Department of Human Services, specifically Judy Moore Peterson and Patty O'Sullivan and everybody over there, because they have looked at this bill and have given us some different options. You'll notice that Judy's testimony mentions that at the end, looking at different ways to fund this. Right now, we have a straight general fund appropriation with a match, a basic Medicaid match. I'm pursuing an amendment to try to take advantage of perhaps a healthy kids inclusion for this population, because then we'd be able to provide the, hopefully with a waiver from the federal government, the SCHIP higher match rate up to the age of 21 for this small population, as well as tapping into the provider tax resources that we're currently using to pay for healthy kids. So I will be back next week with, I have an amendment, but it's not ready for prime time. We have to check with the department, and but hopefully we'll have a different fiscal and an amendment to get us there so we can move it to Ways and Means and hopefully have an other funds fiscal instead of a general fund fiscal. So
thank you.
Hopefully.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3664. Is that the right one?
Oh, yes.
Yes. Okay. And we'll carry this, announce, we'll be carrying this over to next week for a work session next week.
Right.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3667. I don't have a witness list.
Yes, you do.
There okay. We go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3667 directs Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board to contract for health benefit plans to serve limited geographic region of the state under specified circumstances. This has an emergency clause. And I have the dash twos that I'm passing out now that I believe will be spoken to.
While she's passing that out, can I call Jim Bunn and John DiLorenzo, representing Advantage Dental, to the front, please, and then I'll ask Justin Black and Joan Kapovich to be on deck. Who's first?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Bunn, representing Advantage Dental. I've asked John DiLorenzo to join me to deal with the amendments. I speak in favor of House Bill 3667, which is intended to assure regional providers a fair opportunity to compete for state bids and thereby provide OEB and PEB customers with the best possible coverage. If you'll imagine for a moment that you're on the ballot, it's election night, it's 7:59, and you're at the courthouse awaiting the results. Now the county clerk steps forward and announces that you lost. But wait a minute, you say, you haven't counted the ballots. So the clerk counts the ballots and says, see, you still lost.
Actually, it sounds like you and I have both shared an experience like that. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's no fun. So, is this sour grapes to want to repair that process? You may or may not feel good about the outcome of counting, about the counting process that follows the announced outcome, but you sure do not feel good about the outcome being announced before the ballots are counted. That is, in essence, what happened to Advantage Dental. We asked the legislature that regional bids be considered. We asked in 2003, we asked in 2005, and in 2007, the legislature said, yes, regional bids will be considered. For some reason, the words, quote, may not be excluded from competition, end quote, are just not clear enough. With your help, we will use new words to ensure that if a regional provider has the best product at the best price, they will get the contract. And then just briefly behind my comments are a couple of things that I think are helpful.
The first is from the tape pulled from the Education Subcommittee in the 2007 session, where the governor's education advisor talked about the need for regional bids. It was on the record and a part of developing the plan. And then the second is Senator Westland's comments on the Senate floor, assuring us that regional bids were now a part of this bill and made it a better bill. And then the last, you need a magnifying glass to read, but it's actually the firm that did the scoring for the state that said, quote, "We didn't provide scoring on a regional basis to OEB as we discovered that viable options were available statewide, and statewide was our preference." So exactly what the legislature had said was to be done was ignored, and this bill as drafted, we believe, corrects that.
Thank you. Judge Lorenzo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John DiLorenzo, I'm a lawyer with Davis Wright Tremaine, and we are counsel to Advantage Dental. I'm just here to address the Dash 2 amendments. We're not sure whose amendments these are, but they do substitute in two places. If you take the printed bill at page 2, they completely take the place of the amendments in lines 4 through 8. And then the bold language in lines 41 through 45. The printed bill provides that the board shall offer a benefit plan to serve a limited geographic region of the state if they decide that the benefit plan best meets the needs of the region. The amendment provides in both places that the board shall evaluate a benefit plan that serves a limited geographic region of the state according to the criterion section 1. It's our view that if the Dash 2s are adopted, there's really no point to the bill. The purpose of the bill is to provide that if the board concludes that the region is best served by a regional entity as opposed to a statewide entity, then they should do something about it, and they should then offer the plan. The amendments would allow the board to decide that a region is best served by a regional provider, but then do nothing about it. And so we would be better off without any legislation. There's no point to it then. So that's all I have to say about the Dash 2s. Again, I don't know.
Well, let me comment on those. And they came from me after talking to another of your councils or representatives or something, to Greg Shamoy, where he said that your objective was to make sure that that regional plans were considered using the same criteria that everybody else is considered. The question, if it doesn't say they should, and we may have missed that in terms of they should win the contract. I was troubled by the vague language of something like best meet the needs and provide for the welfare. I mean, I have the feeling you're going to end up in that same problem you were ending up before, where how do you define that? So I think if the problem here is that it doesn't say they should be awarded if they win, I think we can work together to create that model. But that's exactly what was intended by the play the same rules, you win by those rules, you're awarded the contract. And that's
well, Mr. Chair, I think we can very easily meld those two concepts together. So we are available to work with you and Legislative Council to accomplish that.
Good.
Are there questions? Are there?
Mr. Chair, yes. My belief is that language, the language that you decided as being arbitrary or being vague, is in fact used in other parts of the statute. And so that language was not made up, but it is in fact the language that's used currently in statute to make those decisions.
Well, their concern was that there's words in the statute right now that are being ignored because they're perceived as being something or other.
Well, but I'm saying that in fact under the language, vague and or if I may,
for the bit needs, yeah,
needs provide for the welfare needs
best
and provide
the needs
in. That in fact that's listed and there are criteria that say that. Is that not correct?
No.
It isn't? No, there's nowhere in this, not in the bill, but in statute in other place.
I don't
so
think
you're
so.
Saying.
Well, what, I mean, it seems to me what we did was we provide specific criteria that defined best meet the needs, and those are the criteria that are used to evaluate any other plan.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Maurer, that comes directly from, if you take a look at Section 1 at the top on page 1 of the bill in line 5, the current statute 243.135 sub 1 says, notwithstanding another benefit plan contracted for or offered by the Public Employees Benefit Board, the board shall contract for health benefit plan or plans best designed to meet the needs and provide for the welfare of all eligible employees of the state. So that's where the language came from. Okay. It was just borrowed again.
But from that, there were criteria that were specifically developed
right.
to implement those words. And it would seem to me you want to make sure you're evaluated by those same criteria that anybody else is using.
Mr. Chair, we do, and we want two things. Number one, we'd like to be evaluated by the criteria. And then number two, if the board decides that we best suit the needs of the area, that they actually act on that evaluation as opposed to merely evaluate it and then do nothing about it.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, the requirement that it be evaluated in combination with the language of the original bill works, but removing the language of the original bill, we believe, creates a problem.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
And we have, here we go, Mr. Black and Ms. Kapowicz. Yeah. Let's move this.
You have to rock and roll?
No, we have to rock and roll, but we're doing fine.
Do you have a preference?
I don't.
Okay.
I'm indifferent.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Black, representing the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 48,000 education employees around the state, most of which are currently covered in OEB. You know, I will say that so far in the last year and a half, 2 years that our members have been covered under OEB, satisfaction has been high. It's not been perfect, but we've been very happy with the plans that have been offered through OEB and the customer service provided by OEB. You know, at the end of the day, the reason that our organization supported a statewide insurance pool for education employees was so that our members could get the best possible plan at the best possible price statewide, and we hope that, you know, that the pool is achieving that. You know, I will talk specifically about the Dash 2 amendments because I believe they come from me. You know, at the end of the day, our members really want the best possible plan, the best possible deal on that plan, whether it be a regional or a statewide carrier, and that we believe that there are some important components in subsection 1 of the statute, such as plan performance, employer flexibility, quality customer care, creativity and innovation, that should be included in the evaluation process. And we felt like the original bill basically set up either a second process for regional carriers to go through that didn't involve that set of criteria.
Original bill or this measure?
The original measure, House Bill 3667.
Okay.
As written.
Last year's.
Not last year's. Okay. This specific bill. That it set up kind of either a second step in the evaluation process for regional carriers that didn't abide by the first section, which has some important components. That's why we came up with the Dash 2 amendments, which, you know, hopefully clearly state that OEB, you know, shall evaluate, you know, benefit plans that service a limited geographic region using the standards that are set up in Section 1, so that both statewide and regional carriers are all being evaluated and that they're all being evaluated on the same criteria. And I will end with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Joan Kapowicz, and I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefits Board. I just had an opportunity to see the Dash 2 amendment, so I won't try to repeat what you've already heard. But in fact, the statute does lay out for both the Public Employees and the Oregon Educators Benefits Board that they do evaluate benefit plans regarding employee choice, prevention, creativity, innovation, cost, flexibility, and those are all very important components to all to both boards. Both boards have, since the PEP board, since at least 2005, I couldn't find earlier ones than that, have in their request for proposal specifically stated the plans did not have to cover statewide. They could cover one county or two or 36. It wasn't excluding you from participation because of that. The PEP board has selected regional and statewide carriers for both medical and dental plans. OEB, when it was forming and came up with request for proposal, interviewed many, many plans for both medical and dental, regional and statewide, and selected regional and statewide plans. Advantage Dental was one of the plans evaluated very thoroughly by board members who went through all the written materials, went through the oral interviews, and then rated each plan according to the criteria outlined in statute. It appears that the Dash 2 does deal with the concern we had, which was that it seemed to move where the evaluation for a regional away from those criteria outlined, and we were concerned that we wouldn't be able to determine how to determine best if we didn't use those criteria. So I think that sums it up. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I have a question for both of you because it'll help where we go from here. Would you have a problem with something like the Dash 2s that said, and if the contract won on those criteria, the contract would be awarded? I mean, would that?
Rep. Greenlick, we would not have any trouble with that.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, as I said, you know, as long as our members end up with the best possible plan at the best price, we're happy.
Yes. Can I? Please, let's have some questions. But so I was going to also suggest that maybe Mr. Black and Mr. DiLorenzo get together and come up with a Dash 3 that meets both there.
No, I want to make clear, because I understand the concern that you want to don't quant or create a third rail. Reasonable. I also, but I think on the other side, is that if in fact a regional plan does meet that criteria, that you don't discard it just because of this little thing there that said statewide was our preference. And I think that was the concern on their side, because the regional plans, I mean, if they're cheaper and better, then that mm-hmm. is also very important.
Representative
that is where I think we're all trying to go.
Okay.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I would like to mention, I don't have what you have in your hand, but I would mention that Advantage did take this matter to court, and all of this information was evaluated over a course of a year and a half, and the Deschutes County Circuit Court judge found that OEB had evaluated appropriately and fairly and made due consideration. So I'll just leave it to that.
This could reduce some ambiguity of what's going on. Yes, please.
Representative Nathanson had her hand up.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kotek. I have a hypothetical question. What are the consequences of the board awarding a regional contract for a county here and a regional contract for a set of two or three counties here and then a regional contract for a different set of counties over here? And cumulatively, the effect of these five or six or seven different regional contracts are you take a bunch of people out of the pool, then what does that do to the contract for all the remaining areas that are the remaining region, if you will? At what point, you know, there's a need to protect the interest of the whole as well as the interests of the smaller region. I don't understand really the hydraulics of that.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Nathanson, I think the issue that you raise is a good one. When the carriers make their bids, they put in what their rate would be for a certain population to be served. In the case that there were a number of regional bidders, let's say, for example, in different counties, that require a certain number of population to be successful, and most of them will then cite what that would be. In that case, a regional carrier potentially might not have as much population and might be in a position to modify their rate because they don't have a certain number of population. But those are, it's hard to say without looking at what your bid exactly what it is, and it would very much determine by numbers. So, but it is, it has a potential impact, but I would only say that was potential. So.
Well, let me follow up, because I think the question is, if the utilization in Grant County is probably too small, but let's say Deschutes County, on average, was lower than the utilization for the rest of the state, and you gave a regional provider Deschutes County, it's going to increase the risk for the rest of the state. I think that was the question you were asking. But I think that's built into the process, and you had at least two regional contracts in Denver that you approved up till now?
Rep. Greenlick, we have one regional for both PEB and OEB, and then one dental that has regional offices.
Okay.
I'd like to close this public hearing. We'll carry, what is this bill? Let's make sure we have this 3667 over till at least Monday. I'd really like it if you and Mr. DiLorenzo could get together and see if we could come up with some language that makes everybody happy. And I think we all agree what we're trying to do is to make sure regional contracts are evaluated in the same way others are and then awarded the contract if they win.
And Mr. Chair, to be clear.
Yes, ma'am.
I personally, as a member on the PEB board, very happy with the dash twos.
Okay.
I think we should be very careful in over-preferencing.
Good.
When there is criterion statute that we have been following for the purpose of being good stewards of public resources. I understand that regional plans should be scored. I think that's the goal of the dash twos. I think it's unfair to go further than that, and I think we should just be careful.
Could we ask you to help get into that discussion?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I like the dash twos. I don't think we need to do anything else.
Okay. Great. Well.
Well, then I have concerns because it doesn't say that, in fact, you'll award it. Even taking Representative Nathanson's concerns into play, that we might be back in the same position. I don't know how the language would look, but I have other concerns about regional contractors.
I'd like to see a dash three, and then we can look at the dash three and compare with the dash two and compare with the basic one and see if on a policy basis we can figure out which one best serves the needs of the state, and that's essentially what we're trying to do. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You guys can come up with one, then we'll ask. Make sure Representative Kotak is filled in on it before we get back together, so briefed on it, and we will have a discussion at that point. Close public hearing and carry over 3667 till Monday and beyond. Mm-hmm. Open up a public hearing on HJR 100, and I'd like to ask Representative Greenlick to open the discussion. Mm-hmm. Hand this over to you. And can I see it?
Can I? Don't. I will gavel you down, sir.
Do it.
Can I have that amendment?
Do you want a copy of the? While he's doing that, do you want me to just read it?
Yes, please.
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, HJR 100. It proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution establishing the right of all Oregonians to the equal opportunity to lead a healthy and productive life, establishes the obligation of the state to ensure that every legal resident of the state access to an effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care, refers the proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general election. You should have a dash one amendment, and you should have a fiscal statement on the dash one amendment as well.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I'm going to be brief as others are, as I'm going to ask everybody else to be for the rest of this hearing. We have offered House Joint Resolution 100, which does a very simple thing. It sends the Constitution
It sends to the voters their chance to opine on whether they think there is a fundamental right to health care such that it should be put in the Constitution of the State of Oregon. It does nothing but that. There's a great Latin phrase that says, res ipso loquitur, let the thing speak for itself. I think most of the argument that I would make is in line 2 through 13 of the dash 1 amendments, a set of whereas clauses. I would ask you to read those whereas clauses, and they pretty much say why I believe health care is a right. Now, the issue here, I think, isn't whether I believe it or you believe it. It's whether we ought to give the people a chance, whether it would be functional and useful, to give the people of the State of Oregon a chance to decide whether they think it's a right and they think so strongly enough to include it in the Constitution of the state. Inclusion of this in the Bill of Rights of the state would compete with such important things as the right to sell whiskey by the glass and a few other things that have happened to put into Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. Also, a clause that says you can't sell whiskey by the glass, but those resolve themselves over time. We have put in place a process with House Bill 2009, Senate Bill 329 first, and House Bill 2009 in the last session that asks the Oregon Health Policy Board to produce a plan for health reform for us, including leading to a plan to move toward universal access, or at least 95% health care for 95% of the population by the year 2015. We're going to have a difficult debate on that. They're debating this plan. We're going to have a difficult debate in 2011. And I really believe whether the voters pass this amendment and put health care as a right in the Constitution or choose not to do so will be very illuminating for the debate we're going to have in 2011. It really will give us a sense of how far the citizens want to push. We all agree health care needs to be reformed. The question is, how far do we need to take that reform and what's the direction? I believe from polling I've done over the time that the citizens will choose to put this in the Constitution, but a lot's happened since we've done any recent polling. We've had the fiasco on the federal side. We've had our debates on Health Care 2000, HB 2009, and I think this is going to be critical information. I ask you to join me and join the folks who will be following me with testimony in support of this bill and move House Joint Resolution 100 onto the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, or we can handle it in the debate.
Questions?
Just a quick question. Or actually, Representative, if this passes out of here, would you promise this committee that on the House floor you will not reference Hobbes, Locke, or Aristotle in your discussion?
Well, I will promise not to do that, although I will probably reference Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson. But I can't speak for Representative Edwards, who is the one who's usually pretty good at that. And for any of you that want a reference on Hobbes and Locke and others, I would suggest you look at the floor hearing on this in the 2007 session and look at the colloquy that Representative Brew and I had on the issue of national rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first panel, and I'm going to go a little bit out of order here, is Paul. And I can't read the last name.
Crystal.
Dr. Huntington. And is it Bob Olson?
Mm-hmm. Brief, everybody.
I didn't do. We'll do the second panel.
Okay.
Chair, it's all yours.
Thank you. Go for it.
Okay, so my name is Paul Crystal, and I serve as chair of the Oregon Health Action Campaign, chair of the board. I also come out of the philanthropic community, having served 12 years on the Northwest Health Foundation board. And for the Oregon Health Action Campaign, we spent decades trying to work for access to accessible health care for all Oregonians. And we've heard horror stories, many of which we brought to you through some of our staff, horror stories of people who have had limited access, who have ended up becoming bankrupt, or have ended up getting care in emergency rooms at a much higher cost than it would be if they were provided with preventive care in a medical home, and or even care for chronic conditions, which if go untreated are clearly more expensive than treating chronic conditions. So all I can say is amen and what he said to Chair Greenlick's remarks. I just wanted to add just a little personal tale of two daughters to this. I'm self-employed now as an organization development consultant. I used to work full-time for a living, and I was lucky enough to have a job that had a retirement plan, and there was a reduction in force. I was one of the lucky few who could take the retirement to save the jobs of some of the younger people because my employer provided retiree health coverage, which covered both of my daughters while they're full-time students, and both of them are no longer full-time students as of last year, so as of January 1st, they're on their own. Youngest daughter is a nurse. She's just got a job at a hospital covered by health insurance. Oldest daughter is a musician. As many artists, she's working as a receptionist for not much more than minimum wage with an employer that doesn't provide health insurance. Actually promised her they would provide health insurance after 3 months, which was January 1st. January 1st came and said, we can't afford it anymore. You're on your own. And she's scheduled to be married in June to another musician who has taken Uncle Sam's gift to musicians, and he's going to join the Army band. So in July, he'll have health insurance paid for by the U.S. government. In that 7 months, if something happens to her, she could go bankrupt. She's eligible for COBRA under my plan, but that's $1,623 per month for a 25-year-old single woman. Obviously, she doesn't make that much, or a little more than that. So she's looking around for some kind of catastrophic plan. If she can find one, what she's seen are $200 or $300 a month. She's not making much more than minimum wage. I mean, this just doesn't seem to be right. I would go a little bit further than Resolution 100 and say, and we've talked about this on the OHAC board, that accessible health care, the health of a citizen, should be a moral obligation of a civil society. The health of all of us is affected by the health of each of us, and I think there's plenty of data on that regard, that even wealthy people with health care are less healthy in societies where there's people that don't have access.
Thank you, Mr. Crystal. And if we have questions along the way, just break in anywhere along the way.
Representative Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Mike Huntington, a retired radiation oncologist and leader of a Physicians for National Health Program chapter in Corvallis. I support HDR 100 for a number of reasons. As a radiation oncologist for 35 years, I saw repeatedly the effects of people not having insurance, not going to the doctor with an early symptom, coming through the emergency room with bleeding or severe pain, and then coming to us for all the expensive care we could think of to try to rescue them. Each time that happened, I became upset and incredulous that our country could allow this to happen. So I would like to talk about the rule of thirds that I've realized. Among them, about a third of the issues that we discussed today would be something you would still need to discuss under a universal access. The other two-thirds wouldn't be even necessary to discuss. A third of us are underinsured or underinsured, and I don't think there's much difference between the two. A third of our healthcare costs go to administrative efforts. A third of us applying for individual policies are denied because of pre-existing illness. And on your handout, you can see a list of those that are used in California. A third of the accepted medical procedures that we use are either ineffective or inappropriately used. And I would guess that a third of us don't know for sure what our healthcare insurance plan is going to come through for us or not.
Dr. Huntington, hold on a second. This handout is Dr. Huntington's handout. It doesn't mention it.
This handout just underscores what is happening with family health and premiums, insurance premiums. They will intersect the total family incomes by year 2025 at the current rate. of course, something will happen long before that that will intercede. Anyway, it's headed for failure. So this system is tragically wasteful of human life, dignity, and resources. I think the only way we can stop this wastage is to have everybody covered, everybody in. So what happens if we obligate the state to do this? Does that mean everybody gets an MRI or CT scan when they want it? Does this mean government-run medicine? No. It simply compels us to do what we should have been doing all along, and that is ensuring effective, medically effective, appropriate, affordable health care for all of us. If we don't deal with this, what I call the one-third rule, in a few years, we will not have enough money to even afford our private delivery of health care. And we will then have to patch together an emergency government-run rescue. You have in front of you also the wordage of the Article 25 of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights passed in 1948, to which this country is a signatory, and also Article 12 of the International Covenant of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights of 1996. And those both guarantee health care to citizens of the nations that signed that. It's not surprising that 64% of the public in this country support the idea that government has a responsibility to ensure universal access to health care. So in spite of what our Uncle Sam has been told repeatedly by the health industry, the market will not cure this health care system. It is more likely to consume our private industry. It's time that we join the rest of the civilized world in providing health care to all of our people. It is in our own best interest, and is the best interest of human life, dignity, and economics. None of us know when we might be the next person to fall into the depths of the third world, one-third world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Huntington. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Chair. Green committee members, very briefly, Bob Olson with the Oregon Chiropractic Association. Your consideration of this resolution highlights the need for Oregonians to have access to a wide range of integrated health care services. And it also involves a very important reality, that is that chiropractors and other complementary health care providers can often provide some of the most effective treatments, improved outcomes, and greatest patient satisfaction. So we just basically wanted to say we really appreciate your efforts to provide affordable care to people, and we're fully supportive of what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panel?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can make the connection between health care as a right and affordability. And I know you get everybody under the umbrella. That makes, you know, that makes sense, but I don't get the connection. At some point, you're going to say medical oncologist, you're going to make $75,000 a year, and that's your cap. And someone's going to dictate what your salary is. And I don't think that is necessarily going to fly so well.
Well, all the resolution says is that right is for access to effective, medically appropriate, and affordable health care.
And
so the question, how do we achieve that is?
No, it's who defines it? And it's put in the Constitution, and I guarantee it's not going to be the individual. It's going to be the state. And the state is the wrong place for that decision to be made.
Actually, my guess is it'll be the courts, but that's a different question.
Well, that's part of the state, huh?
Yeah. Representative Thompson.
I anticipated my question. If we were to adopt this, who holds the liability for the inability to provide a certain standard? Are we locking ourselves into a choice between health care or schools in an economic downturn? And I suspect it's the court. If I, as a citizen, don't feel that I'm getting the adequate health care that I want or need, I will sue the state of Oregon and take this into court to have a decision on what this means.
Just
for
as
me.
In the Constitution, which provides for the state to provide a common system of schools. When that went to court, the court said, yes, that's in the Constitution, but the state can only provide what they can reasonably provide. And I suspect that's the precedent that would be involved in this. It is an aspirational goal. It took 70 years to come close to getting a common system of schools, and we still haven't gotten it. But it's in the Constitution, and it affects our behavior. I mean, it's something that we try and do. But let's excuse this. We'll get, unless there's a question for those folks. And let's ask Mr. Buckstein to join us, who's the only person signed up in opposition, perhaps. He'll have an opinion on your question as well, Representative Thompson. Let's see. Are we going to have 2 days in a row where we agree, you think?
No.
Maybe.
I got something right.
That's too much to ask, Steve.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy research organization in Portland. We had time for a longer discussion about this, 2007, Chair Greenlake, I think,
when
the bill was up earlier. And since I don't get a chance to talk on the floor, I guess I can mention Locke and other philosophers. I won't quote from them, but I do really want to talk about three aspects of this, the philosophical, the practical, and the political, just to sort of get them on the record. And I'm sure there'll be, if it does go to the voters, there'll be a lot more chance to talk about these. But on the philosophical level, I object to defining healthcare as a right, or more precisely, what philosophers call a positive right. This would be, in my view, a so-called positive right. This country was founded on the belief that government cannot create rights. At best, it can protect our inalienable rights to things like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which again, in philosophical terms, are negative rights. Nobody has to sacrifice their rights for you to have the right to life, to liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. But if we call health care a right, which again, I think is defined as a positive right, there are people who have to then sacrifice or are burdened, their rights are burdened. Number one, the people who are required to pay for the health care, their rights to some extent are burdened. And number two, the people who are required to provide the service. Now, you may think, again, there are people who love to provide health care services, but I think it was mentioned earlier, what happens when there's a cap on the remuneration for those services. Those people are still required if there's a right. If I have a right to health care, someone has an obligation to provide it to me, whether I pay them or not. On a political level, I understand that government grants these kind of rights all the time. I'm not here to argue that you can't do it. Obviously, you know, you can do it. But I think that it creates problems. In the first instance, it'll make a lot of people feel good. We now have a right to health care in Oregon. We care deeply about the uninsured, and I understand that. But I think defining health care as a fundamental right really does leave the cost question then in real doubt, as was discussed earlier. I think cost control, in effect, has a risk of going out the window, because you look at the public school system, as was mentioned before, and we now have the quality education model. Public education is, I don't think it's called a fundamental right in the Oregon Constitution. We are required, you're required to provide a system of common schools, but you're not required to fund them to any particular level. The goal is the quality education model. But that drives higher costs without any assurance of higher quality. And I think if we go down the route of making health care a fundamental right, I can see in the future what I would call, or what you would call, I think, the quality health care model, modeled along the lines of the quality education model, defining prototype health clinics, how many customers should be served, how many counselors there are, the same sort of thing as in the QEM, staffing levels, required tests. I think innovation will become mired in a bureaucratic morass if that happens, to the detriment of just about everybody. So rather than spend your limited political capital and time on defining or trying to define healthcare as a right, I think you should concentrate more on issues like making health insurance premiums for individuals tax deductible, which this committee has already taken up, reducing the cost of healthcare, making it more affordable for everybody, hopefully, without defining it as a right. And then, if there are still people who cannot afford health care, use a model that I think is less damaging to the economics of the system, something like the food stamp system. You know, people who can't feed themselves, you know, you provide food stamps.
But you don't dictate where they buy their food to a great degree. You don't set up the kind of quality education model that I'm afraid would happen with healthcare if you define it as a right. So with that, I'll leave the all three levels of discussion for later.
And I do just want to point out that the government can't provide this right. Only the people can under the Oregon Constitution. So that's why this refers us to the people, because it's only the people by amending the Constitution that can do this.
Yes, Chair Greenlick, I agree. It does have to be a constitutional amendment, but that doesn't change the nature of the what I define as a positive right. It would still have these problems, whoever approved it.
Yep. Representative Cannon.
Thank you. Just indulge me with a quick question on the philosophical point you've made, the distinction between positive and negative rights. We've made it in the past. I'm trying to understand it. It would seem to me that a civil or political right, or say even the right to life, which you've defined as a negative right, does create an obligation on the part of someone, at least, to protect us. And for example, my right not to be attacked on the street requires protection. We have a police force. We pay through that through taxation. There's an obligation then for others to pay for the police to protect me. So I think that distinction between positive and negative is harder to maintain than it might first appear.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, it may be hard to maintain, but I think we have to. I think our founding fathers were very clear that negative rights, the right to life, doesn't require someone to feed you or clothe you or provide you medical care. It requires that they not take your life, that they, basically the purpose of government under our system is to protect your right to life by hopefully stopping the criminal who's going to take your life or injure you or whatever. That's very different than requiring that someone provide you with a service, which is a positive right. Yeah. Requiring to provide you with health care, I think, is in a different category than not violating your health, not taking your life.
Except those folks who proclaimed the right to life were about to commit treason and required the raising of an army to protect them from having King George take their life, I think, at that point. See, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I call Brian DeBlashman, Martin Taylor, and Mike Grady, please? And the only other one I have signed up so far after that is Len Bergstein on behalf of Twality Healthcare.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLeischmidt, representing the Oregon Nurses Association, at the risk of running much longer than I did last night and appearing 2 days in a row in this committee, I would just say that the Oregon Nurses Association has had a longstanding position on this measure, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Ah, you did. You were 15, 20 seconds longer?
Yeah.
I do need to comment, historically, I tried to put this on as an initiative in the 2006 time period and gathered 125,000 signatures, still leaving it about 18,000 signatures short. But the Oregon Nurse Association was a huge participant and partner in that, and it was very much appreciated. Yes.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Mike Grady. I'm a family physician in Silverton. I come and speak in favor of HJR 100. I'm a member of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, physicians for National Health Plan, the Archimedes Movement. But I'm here tonight to talk on behalf of my patients. I speak for the 64-year-old man, uninsured with a potentially serious illness, who rolled the dice, waiting 6 months until he was Medicare eligible to get a workup. He won that gamble, but then saw his wife and teenage daughter, who had special needs, be taken off the Oregon Health Plan because at the same time he got Medicare, he got a modest Social Security payment. I speak for the 40-year-old woman with bipolar illness, finally stable enough on medication to get a job, only to find that her minimum wage job disqualified her from the Oregon Health Plan and from the medications and the mental health therapy that made her feel well and made her productive. Since then, I've watched her deteriorate with psychotic behavior again to the point that continuing her job and not being eligible for OHP are literally threatening her life. I speak for my diabetic patient, who within a few months of losing her OHP coverage, unable to afford her many medications, was hospitalized here in Salem for 15 days after going into diabetic ketoacidosis. She spent 11 of those days on a ventilator in the ICU. I believe all of these patients have a right to a level of health care in which they don't have to delay medical care and gamble their lives or see their loved ones lose their coverage just as they gain theirs. They have a right to a basic level of care there that does not make them choose between a job and the basic health services that make them able to work. Our current system, which sets up these categories of deserving and undeserving poor and then denies basic care to the latter, is morally indefensible. Reasonable people will argue about whether using the language of rights is the correct approach to assuring basic health care. This resolution appropriately contains references to both the right and the responsibility of society. I believe it is time to make explicit the right that we implicitly accept. The fact that anyone can go into an emergency room anywhere, receive essentially unlimited care any number of times without a demonstration of ability or intention to pay, can do that repeatedly, seems to say that we think about this sort of access to basic health care differently than we do other goods and services. I mean, really, try doing that at Costco. I mean, this, there's something different about health care, and it's time that we recognize that. If there's not a right to health care, then it seems that this right that would make other goods and life itself possible, and it seems silly to talk about rights at all, unless we want to talk about the whiskey thing a little bit more. So it's proper that our state would lead our country, I think, in joining other industrialized societies in recognizing this fact. It's frankly embarrassing, I think, probably to have to seek an amendment like this in countries that that have more of a sense of solidarity than we have in this country. I think the right and responsibility would be assumed. I'll close by saying that it's been a while since the good sisters were the ones that provided the care and did the administration at St. Vincent's Hospital. And that's true of all the large hospitals now, once run by religious orders. They're now all large corporations. But I think it says something that we keep the names, you know, St. Vincent, Good Samaritan, Adventist, Beth Israel. To my knowledge, there's not a Good Samaritan Hardware. There's not an Adventist Auto Parts. We keep these names because we recognize that what happens there is something more than just a transaction of business between providers and consumers. It's a ministry, and it's an important way that we show community. So let's be bold enough to declare a right to an essential health care benefit for all citizens and the possibility for life that that ensures. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
One quick question.
Go ahead.
Does the right for health care create an obligation to accept it and to seek it?
Does Representative Meyer?
Example, okay. Diabetic patient, non-compliant diabetic patient, you have them. I'm assuming you have them.
I have plenty of them.
Okay. They now, if it's a right, it is now an obligation to society to abide by the doctor's orders. I'm sitting here as you were talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All we're talking about in this right is the right to access to health care.
Access to health care. So I have diabetic patients who are uncontrolled for a long time, but their continued access to see me makes it available for that time when they are ready to be more compliant with their care. Or the other many factors that contribute to their health are improved, that they will be able to come and we will be able to use those moments to improve their care at that time.
Mr. Taylor, you're on.
Uh, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I'm Martin Taylor. I'm representing CARE Oregon. I should start by saying that last time I spoke to this issue in 2007, I was with the Oregon Nurses Association, and by my side was Dave Ford, the CEO of CARE Oregon, testifying on the bill. I didn't know him at the time, thought he did a good job. We drew straws for who got today. It was me. And
did you have the short straw or the long straw?
This is privileged information. But he sends his regards. I would like to start by saying that when Representative Greenlick started this hearing, he asked the correct question, which is really who should decide whose rights these are, and whether health care is a fundamental right or not. And I would offer to you that after all of the thought that you give to the question yourself, is health care a right or not, I would suggest that it is clearly not a novel question in our society or our planet whether health care is a right, and that the people themselves should decide. We have a social contract where the people determine their rights. So to give them an opportunity to do that would be a reasonable thing to do, even if you did not personally believe that health care is a right. You know, there's always a risk of telling a specific story, and the story that I'd like to tell you came from my experience a number of years ago working on the HOPE initiative collecting signatures, and I don't remember enough of the details. So I'm going to use this as a story without a specific. We talked to many folks. The one that was most compelling to the question you're asking was a gentleman who was about my age at the time, so in his late 30s, who had a daughter, who had a mom whose house he was living in, who was not in the workforce, and his situation was he was providing for that entire family. His daughter had health care through the Oregon Health Plan. Because they did not have much money, he did not qualify. He did not want to get poor enough because he wanted to keep the house. Getting poor enough meant losing the house, losing his mom's house. So the question that he asked us was, why is it that my daughter has a right to health care and I don't? And when I get sick, it disrupts the income of this family. And we had met him at a time where he was taking, he had been buying his antibiotics from a feed store because it was less expensive and he didn't need a doctor's prescription. It was a sad story. But his story is your story. Your story is Ben right? Why does his daughter have a right to health care and he doesn't? Is it capricious to say that if his mom was a little older and she got health care, or his daughter who was young enough or poor enough got health care, or if you were a veteran or disabled, you might get health care, but Ben didn't? That's the question. And who gets to decide that for Ben? It takes us to the first piece of material I hand out to you. It's a number of articles around language of the commons that Don Berwick is introducing to a national discussion, but the commons is a very old thought. The commons essentially says we in society share some things. There's a Nobel Prize in Economics awarded to the woman who developed this as a modern economic theory, and it says, you know, we share our forests, our fish in the waters. We share, the specific example they always use is the pasture land in these Scottish towns where everyone grazes their sheep in common. And they have established that you have an equal right to graze your sheep on that land. You can't say to one member of the community, this is the common pasture except for you. And Ben's like, but it's except for him. Like, why don't I have that same access? And I think it gets to this question of positive and negative rights. When our founding fathers were creating this country, they were doing so with a specific paradigm. They were being oppressed by a monarch who treated them like property. Literally, people were property. You might remember that didn't exactly get solved with the writing of the Constitution, but much of the development of that was to say, you have positive right for free speech, for freedom of religion, to be my own person. I get to be my own person. That's what they were expressing. And they put it in the Constitution. And those negative rights, those natural rights embodied in the Constitution, remain. Now, there have been a whole lot of people who have written constitutions since then, all over the planet. And many of those constitutions actually have positive rights too, a right to something. In the UN Charter, we have a right to something. In our states, we have a right to something. The right to something is important because the right to is the right to the commons. It's the right expressed to say, you're an equal member of society, you have equal value, you have an equal right to what is shared. And that does require paying something. It does require taxation. It does require giving up of a little bit of yourself to support the commons, to support our public education system, which we share, our roads, which we share, our 911 system, which we share. And if you told Ben that the situation was his daughter didn't have access to the schools, we'd all be offended that he didn't have a right to the commons, because we now understand that as a right. And if you said you don't have a right to 911 or you don't have a right to the road, we'd all be offended. We'd understand that's not right. Ben has every right to those same things that we hold in common. The problem here is we do not accept in this country, in this state, that health care is part of the commons. We don't accept the idea that that part of who we are that makes us, gives us the opportunity to survive, that allows us to be fully embodied people, that is health care, we treat it differently than our education or our safety or our ability to move on the roads. So that's the question you should ask the people of Oregon. Is that right? Is that a correct distinction? And I will tell you that the system that we have now is absolutely an irrational system. We spend more money in this country on healthcare, not necessarily as, you know, through our taxes, but collectively in all the ways. We spend more money on healthcare than any other country, and we get poor results. To say, well, we don't want to have a government-run bureaucratic system that looks like our schools or our 911 system or our roads is simply irrational when you have a system as poorly run as the one we've got that leaves so many people in the situation that Ben is at. Can't make the case that our system is better than the possibility of having a commons around healthcare. It would be a difficult transition. And what it does mean is today, in a way, and what Berwick says in his article, is we do have a commons. And that commons is we have a whole lot of public money going to healthcare, and there are folks grazing on it. There are hospitals and insurance companies and doctors, and they're eating all of the grass. It's way too expensive. They're not treating that public dollar correctly. If the commons belonged to each of us, as citizens, as Ben's, we'd be better custodians of it than what we're doing now, which is basically commoditizing healthcare, turning it into a property right, and letting the wrong folks graze. So I think this is a question that you should bring back to the voters to decide. I passed out some information that gives you some public polling information on it. I think you'd find that in this country it is a popular idea, and it may not be a popular idea with each of you as legislators, but I would challenge you to say this is something that most nations in many countries in this world recognize as a right. It's not an unfair thing for you to let the voters' opinion of this supersede your own.
I can ask you all to hang in for a little bit. I am going to go into a work session on this and hope to move this. So, thank you all very much. Last witness, Mr. Bergstein. We're also going to give Representative Thompson a vote on a vote he missed.
They can vote quickly.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Len Bergstein. I'm here representing Dick Stenson, who's the CEO and president of Tuality Healthcare, and he wishes that he was here and sends you his best. Under the chairman's rule of res ipsa loquitur, I think I will let the letter speak for itself. It obviously stands for the fact that Tuality Healthcare would like to see this bill passed and is willing to roll up its sleeves and help pass the amendment at the polls. That's all I want to deliver, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mm-hmm. I guess before I close the public hearing, I want to make a closing statement. And it is a personal statement. In 2005, at the end of the session, I was diagnosed with lymphoma. And that got me seriously interested in thinking of the question about what happened if I didn't have health care, if I didn't have access to health insurance. It was the beginning of the diagnostic journey happened in a dental visit that I would not have been at if I didn't have health insurance, I think, if I were poor and didn't have health insurance. And it went on through a complicated diagnostic process, a very complicated system of infusions for chemotherapy and now regular CAT scans, regular follow-up visits, and if I happen to go into remission, which I'm sure I'm not going to, it'll be back in that. And frequently as I sat in the infusion clinic having a few thousand dollars worth of drugs dripping into my arm, I really did think about what would have happened. And it is very clear to me what would have happened is I would have died. And here I am, 5 years later, not having died. Now, I was in that 10% of the population that year, to say nothing of the fall I took 2 years later and spent another $100,000 in health care. I mean, it really came home to me how privileged I was, how our society was divided between people who were privileged, who had health insurance, and people who weren't, in a matter of life and death. And that redoubled my
and this has always been my interest, that really redoubled my interest in making sure the citizens of the state of Oregon had a chance to discuss and vote on this matter. I'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 100 and open up a work session on House Joint Resolution 100, partly revolution.
Exactly, that's how it starts.
And ask the Vice Chair for a motion, please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the LC-1 amendment, dated January 28th, this year, 2010, to HJR 100.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Yes, is there discussion? I'm sorry. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question. I highlighted one phrase in the amendment. Thank you.
I'm sorry to highlight.
Thank you. Bright yellow here. Without launching into like another hour philosophical debate, could you amplify just a bit on the phrase medically appropriate?
Yes, that's not only on the amendment. That's in the heart of the bill itself. We have been spending the last almost decade trying to create ways to look at what healthcare is medically appropriate. But the sense of both effective, medically appropriate, and affordable, which are all used together in the part of this that would, in fact, go into the Constitution, is to put sideboards around it. Because one of the things that we're dealing with in terms of how to provide healthcare is to say, does this mean everybody is entitled to anything that they want? If you offer this guarantee of access, does that mean everything? And what we're talking about here is limiting that to what there is a sense actually makes a difference and is appropriate. Now, that's a term of art, and it emerges. What's medically appropriate 10 years ago is different than what's medically appropriate now, and is different what would be medically appropriate a decade from now, where the science emerges. And what this is, as I said, this is an attempt to, it is a term of art. The insurance companies define that now when they deliver care, and it's an attempt to point out that this is not a total unlimited right to anything anybody thinks they want. That's the intent of that term.
Thank you.
Yep. No. Representative Thompson?
I have the same concern about the word affordable. How we would ever define that when you're establishing a right. Government can never plead inability to pay because they have the right of taxation and fee increases. I mean, I can make healthcare affordable right now, more affordable, if I reduce the salaries of all medical practitioners by 50%. Is that a smart thing to do? No.
Well, it might be a smart
thing
to do.
But I can affect affordability. And I just, there's something about a lack of definition there, especially in a government system, because there is no limit on what we can collect. If we accept the fact we have to pay for a set standard for everybody. I mean, even in roads today, we maintain roads. Well, we really don't, because roads in secondary areas of the state are not as well maintained as I-5, and we recognize that discrepancy. But when you get into healthcare as a guarantee for everyone, you don't really have that flexibility to say, well, if you live 67 miles east of the Cascades, you don't quite get the healthcare you do in Portland. I think there's a huge liability locked into this, tied to the affordability.
Understand, even if this passes and becomes a part of the Constitution, it doesn't produce a government healthcare system. All it says is the government has to assure access to people. And certainly this isn't the promise of the government taking over the healthcare system.
I guess the distinction I'd like to make is I understand the philosophy of where we want to go. And I think we've embarked in that with health care reform in Oregon, whether we all agree with the method or not. I think I would rather put the emphasis on building a house for a poor person and knowing that I can do that, rather than guaranteeing a house for a poor person when I have no mechanism or means to provide that. If I could flip a switch and we could do this tomorrow, we don't have facilities, we don't have procedures, we don't have practitioners, we can't provide health care at a reasonable level for everybody equally tomorrow.
Well, A, it doesn't say provide.
Well, okay.
And B, it doesn't say equal. In fact, in the past,
if I'm a citizen out there on the street and I have a right to health care, I know what provide means. You better do it.
You have a right to access to health care.
Yeah. I think it's a slippery slope.
Can we deal with the amendment first and then finish this discussion? If there's no objection to the amendment, which takes all these words out of what would be in the Constitution but puts it in the whereas statements, we'll, without objection, accept the amendment. And now let's have a motion on the resolution as amended, and then we'll continue this discussion for as long as you want.
Well then, Mr. Chair, I move HJR 100 as amended to the floor with the adopted recommendation.
The adopted recommendation. Okay, we have on the floor you got that one right. a motion to move HJR 100 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Representative Maurer,
I will not say anything. This is the sixth or seventh time I will have voted on it.
Really?
Yeah.
It feels like committee and four.
Yeah, committee and four.
Fifth time, right?
Yeah.
And I think everything's been said.
Is it time now to vote yes?
No.
Seventh's a charm.
Seventh. Wow. Okay. Let's move on. Let's okay. Cut to the chase.
Any other discussion? I'm sure we'll have a spirited discussion on the floor.
Mr. Chair, if I may, this is not a question or even a comment. I just to sort of back up what Mr. Maurer is saying, because a lot of people are hearing this and seeing this. Maybe it's the first time. I would only encourage people to go back and look at the legislative record, because a lot of the people up here have had long and lengthy conversations on this right. exact issue. So
yeah, and also look at the difference in wording, because the wording has been carefully crafted after a lot of discussions. In past, it has said every equal access, and I think we recognize access isn't going to be necessarily equal unless we have a perfectly utopian world. We're never going to get that. It also, in a past version, required the legislature to do something, and that seemed appropriate not to put into the Constitution to make this a really straightforward and aspirational. So it's emerged over time, and listening to people, trying hard to listen to people, even those who are not in favor of it. Okay. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bruin?
No.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Coyle?
Aye.
Representative Kimmer? Excuse. Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Close the work session on...
Carrier.
Carrier.
It's a huge issue.
Oh, I'll carry it. And close the work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would ask unanimous consent to allow Representative Thompson to vote on House Bill 3626. Oh, I'm sorry. Motion to suspend the rules to permit or allow.
Or whatever.
It shall remain. 3626.
Is there any objection? Representative Thompson.
I appreciate your consideration. I was actually held up on official business, not just tardy, and I vote yes.
Could you support the yes vote? Is there anything else to be brought before the committee?
Thank Mr.
You.
Chair,
yes, sir.
I want to compliment you on the graciousness of how you have handled all of this. and it obviously could be very contentious, but it hasn't been, and I appreciate
thank you very much.
Kindness of heart.
Thank you. We are adjourned.
All right.